Today on Vox Talks Economics, can neuroscience help economists investigate how we learn from experience? Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics, so remember to subscribe and follow us on Instagram as well. When we live through a financial crisis, many of us think differently about money afterwards. Has the experience given us new information, or does it actually rewire our brains, potentially affecting our behaviour for decades? A new discussion paper analyses the empirical evidence about so-called experience effects and examines what neuroscience can tell economists about them that might help future research. Ulrico Malmondier of the University of California, Berkeley, and CEPR is the author. Ulrico, welcome to Vox Talks Economics.
Hi, Tim. Great to talk to you.
Ulrico, I said we think differently about money after a crisis. Is the evidence that this effect is long-lasting, or does it just change us for a year or two?
I believe that at this point, we've accumulated really strong evidence that it is long-lasting. There is also short-term impact it has on everybody, but you can think about famous examples such as the so-called depression babies in the US, people who lived through the Great Depression who supposedly were altered for the rest of their lives. Or you can think about my home country, Germany, where the experience of the hyperinflation early in the 20th century seems to have changed the German nation's attitude towards inflation in a very long-lasting manner.
But we also know, don't we, that half a century ago, Kahneman and Tversky came back with this famous result that we give far too much weight to recent events when we make decisions. Is that also true in this case?
Yes, it is absolutely true. And in fact, that's probably what more economists have picked up on their research. Mm. There is recency bias. If when we are weighing what has happened in our lifetime so far, we do put extra weight on stuff that happened quite recently. But that doesn't rule out that big enough events and experiences further back in our lives still exert influence in a lasting manner. In fact, you can bring the two of them nicely together. You can take my research and my collaborators and research teams on experience effects to say we all provide evidence that all of our lifetime experiences have a lasting impact on us. However, it doesn't mean we weigh them equally. We weigh them with some recency bias, exactly in the spirit of Kahneman and Tversky.
These experience effects, do they mean that we just got scared of the bit of finance that was at the center of the crisis and affected us directly, like we might be scared of buying a house in the future or don't want to invest just in the stock market? Or do we become more cautious about finance in general?
Yeah, you're bringing up a really important point. So just to give a little bit of context, I think traditionally economists wouldn't have thought about experiences changing our attitudes towards risk at all, right? We're kind of born with a certain set of risk preferences, and then we might experience bad outcomes. But, you know, we remain the same people. And now we come along and say, no, we are altered. Having lived through, say, the housing crisis will alter our attitudes towards housing. And indeed, exactly as you're implying in the first half of your question, it is quite specific. So I think once economists were starting to get ready to accept the concept of these experiences changing our risk attitudes, many of us wanted to apply it to everything because, you know, if I now have a negative attitude towards that asset A and there's another one that's correlated, well, of course, it translates into that. But instead, what we are finding very much motivated by neuroscience is that the specific context has an overproportional influence on where it affects us. So it is the case that, for example, take the recent pandemic crisis, that if you lived in a country where maybe the job market was affected, you lost your job, or there's job insecurity, that is likely, I mean, we predict it will shape your attitudes towards future job searches and career choices. But if you are, say, in the US where the stock market did fairly well, we're not predicting at all that you are scared of the stock market through that crisis.
Is this universal? I'm just thinking about our audience. And there'll be some people who are very skeptical about this sort of thing because they're educated about risk and return, markets and crises. So maybe they might be immune to these sort of scarring effects that affect most people.
So I'm here to say it affects everybody.
Okay.
And I understand your skepticism if you are highly educated. I'm a finance professor and I still exhibit these effects within the finance realm. I do have some evidence to back it up other than, you know, personal anecdotal evidence, which is, for example, we have looked at many applications of experience effects. And one is inflation, which I mentioned earlier, talking about, you know, my home country. So we found in an earlier paper that your lifetime experience of inflation really shapes your views and fears and expectations about future inflation. And we did this originally with a really broad data set representative of the US population in that case. In a later paper, we looked specifically at the top central bankers in the country, the FOMC members, the members of the Federal Open Market Committee in the US, so the top Fed people, governors and regional Fed presidents. And we kind of did the same exercise again. When they twice a year do a forecast to Congress in their monetary policy report and say, put down their estimate on inflation over the next year or various other estimates, can we predict how much they're deviating into a hawkish or dovish direction? I mean, up or down, by their personal lifetime experiences? And the answer is yes. So I am strongly convinced that everybody's affected by that. Our personal experiences reshape the wiring of our brain, and that's nothing that gets eliminated by abstract education.
I'm not sure whether that's good or bad to know, really. In economics, we usually think of these changes as updating our preferences in different domains, don't we? We have new information, we add it to our mental model of the world. This is quite simple, it's elegant, you can teach it. Is it enough to explain everything that we're observing here?
Another excellent question, Tim. So just to kind of clarify what you said before, often we think about two channels. So one is updating, and that's updating of beliefs typically, and one is preferences. And so we are sticking to these two channels, and then I often get the question very much as you ask them, so what channel is at work? And so far in my work, I found lots of evidence on it going through a belief channel, or at least you can model it through a belief channel. So meaning if I've lived through like really bad outcomes in the stock market, I tend to be more pessimistic about future realizations of the stock market. Of course, that doesn't rule out that preferences are at work as well, right? So it could also be the case that my preferences are changing as I'm developing and shaping my attitudes towards the world in the specific asset. So the easy answer for me is, well, I have evidence that it goes through updating of beliefs and there might be preferences at work and I can't rule that out. But in fact, I think you cannot rule it out. However, I have to say that people who are working in this area are starting to think that maybe we need to do away with preferences. Maybe we need to have a kind of a simpler mental model which revolves around beliefs. And we need to go back to the very beginnings of economics when people like Savage were actually, you know, they were much less certain that we need to have these two channels and they are distinct. They're saying you can map from one to the other. So there might be some very fundamental reckoning that could be happening right now as a result of these types of results.
That's very interesting. I mean, another idea that has been very popular over the last couple of decades is that people just don't know enough about the things that they make decisions on, finance being a really good example of that, or they are unable to use all the information that they could get to make their decisions. Is this a good enough explanation for what we observe?
These traditional economic explanations are super important and are powerful. So I just want to make it really clear that I do think a financial education, financial literacy, ability to process all of the information that's available to you are key factors we need to continue to work on and as policymakers, you know, try to improve, etc. However, the limitation has been that I think a lot of the thinking went in the direction of that's it. So if you have lived through the financial crisis and then are scared about investing in the stock market again, to think that by just explaining really well the benefits of a diversified stock market investment and, you know, improving your financial literacy on return calculations would fix the problem, that has been the limitation. I think it will be much more powerful if we understand, well, you know, Tim, in my hypothetical example, lived through this experience, and we now need to give him a different experience. We need to give him a taste for what stock market investment is like in the long run, and that this was an outlier, and just get you back into the stock market and let you experience the positive outcomes. So understanding the limitations of teaching and knowledge, in particular abstract knowledge, is something I would be very much promoting as a result of my research.
Because one of the missing pieces of the jigsaw in your argument is this neuroscience explanation, the physical changes that occur in our brains as a result of these experiences. What changes are these, and how can we link them to our reactions, our biases?
Yeah, so neuroscience and talking to, you know, cognitive scientists, neuropsychiatrists mm-hmm. has been a great source of inspiration, information, stimulation for my research. Just to be clear, I am absolutely not a neuroscientist. I'm not even a neuroeconomist. So I'm not one of these people who, you know, sticks people into MRIs and tries to understand how the amygdala talks to other parts of the brain. But what has been so incredibly helpful in reading about experiments and the findings in that literature is to understand that we should think about the brain, right, where we form our beliefs and where somehow I think our preferences are rooted. This brain is what psychiatrists call a use-dependent organ. It's the use-dependent brain that changes as mm-hmm. we are evolving. So I think all of us who have kids know about how, you know, the brain of kids is developing, exploding. Of course, as parents, we are hoping to have an influence in kind of how the neural pathways are shaped. But one of the really well-established facts now is that our brain keeps changing as we evolve. We keep forming new synapses, strengthening synapses, abandoning other ones, so the connections between neurons. And that's something that doesn't translate at all into the model, into the somewhat static model of a human we have in economics. Sure, as you said earlier, we always acknowledge we update beliefs, but it's very much like a firm system where you feed in the information and then you're processing and you might come to new results, but the whole system is not changing. So I like to compare it to a computer system where, you know, a lot of economists have worried about, is the information fed in, inputted, the correct one, right? If humans make mistake, we said, oh, it's asymmetric information, it's biased information that is fed to the human that explains it. If we only remove informational asymmetry, problem solved. And they realized, no, people are processing it differently. And so then we went, in particular, we behavioral economists went a lot to software issues, so to speak, right? There's a biased system that processes it like in a biased manner. And sure, that also explains a lot of things. But if we fix that, still, the problem doesn't seem to be solved. I mean, the problem in quotes, the fact that we overly respond to what we have personally experienced. And what I've taken from neuroscience is the idea that as we are living through life, we're actually getting rewired. Our hardware changes, our connections change, the way we process things. So for example, certain stimuli arriving get processed very fast and get connected very fast to another outcome. Think about the stock market, the Great Depression. Depression babies will immediately connect anything about the stock market with fear and suffering and loss and all sorts of negativity. And that connection is just super fast and super strong, faster than everything else. And as a result, they will have these negative associations and reluctance to invest in the stock market. So I'm really grateful to neuroscience for giving me this kind of dynamic hardware type of thinking about how we humans think about the world.
But Ulrika, neuroscience, it's pretty new stuff. It's evolving. The sort of experiments that they're doing are right on the leading edge, aren't they? How confident can you be in making this link between brain structure and the sort of behavior that you're interested in?
Yeah, excellent question. So I certainly have to always be very clear that I'm not doing neuroscience or even neuroeconomics, as I said, in kind of saying, oh, see, these areas of the brain light up and now you're choosing the more tempting good rather than the non-tempting good, etc. So I'm actually not even out there to make these kind of direct one-to-one connections. It's partly, well, because I wasn't maybe trained in it, but also very much for the reason you are pointing out here. So it's super highly evolving and we have to be really careful. In particular, if you go to the really refined molecular level of neuroscience findings, linking that to specific choice we make as humans in real life, I think we have to be very careful. So your point is well taken. Having said that, using the knowledge neuroscientists have today about how we are responding to stimuli, what is happening when a piece of, call it information or just call it a stimulus, right, arrives, somehow gets inputted, how it's going through our brain and connecting one neuron firing, connecting to another neuron, has been incredibly eye-opening. It's just the very fact that this is so far away from this static, cemented model of a human born with certain preferences and then just kind of updating the beliefs, whether it's a biased manner or an unbiased manner, behavioral or not, I don't even care about, but this is much more cemented and static than what we just know from biology and neuroscience. I'm very confident that this type of knowledge will not change, right? That this is very firmly established. We are still trying to figure out, oh, but then if certain synapses are strengthened, how exactly does that process work? What leads to long-term potentiation? What is synaptic tagging? So there I'm all with you that I have to be careful in acknowledging, well, maybe 5 years out, or even, don't know, the science goes so fast, 2 years out, you know, we might have a different view. But I would stand here and say that this basic insight about the use-dependent brain, about it being shaped by lifetime experiences. If you read neuroscience literature, you can't imagine how often you find the word experience and shaped by experience, which of course for me was great. I think that is here to stay. It is in that sense a kind of a motivation and an inspiration. I do think we can learn more from reading the literature. So for example, rather than linking specific functioning of the hippocampus to certain choices, instead reading in the literature about, okay, how do people respond to stressors or trauma? How does it vary by gender? How does it vary by age on onset, by duration of the stressor? How does it vary by socioeconomic background and support? There are these various literatures who have very robust findings. They come from immunology, neuroscience, hormonal studies, etc. And I think there are some facts emerging from all these different literatures, which are very robust. And as economists, getting to know them more and studying will be incredibly helpful in moving this field forward, which is all about right now better understanding how we form beliefs.
You describe this as an inspiration, but I'm interested in inspiration to what in your research? Are there particular questions that you think that this approach is going to lead us to greater insights than our traditional finance or behavioral finance models?
The most direct piece of application that I feel is ready to be incorporated on all fields of economics is this acknowledgement that our personal lifetime histories, what we've lived through in our life so far, has highly significant predictive power for our future decision making. If you think about economics today, you know, we're trying, say, to explain how much a person is saving or what career choice or educational choice that person is making. We tend to have this view that we, as economists, want to get all the current factors that describe this person, her current wealth, her current education, family background, income, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe some indicators of how the future is likely going to be involved. And then we're all set, right? Then we can predict what this person will be doing. However, say if, you know, if you and I are choosing whether to enroll in college or not, and suppose right now we have the same financial and family situation, but I came from a working class background, nobody has studied, I made my way there, and say you came from a noble British family, you're born with a silver spoon in your mouth, etc. Then even though we truly exactly comparable right now, I mean, this got to predict the future. Right? Mm-hmm. This got to predict your choices. And this acknowledgement that in this day and age where we have so much data availability, there are administrative data sets, there are scraping opportunities, it has become so much easier to collect the whole past. Bringing that in and bringing that in as we are predicting labor choices, as we are predicting earnings choices, I think is what all fields of economics should be doing. And I think it's immediately applicable.
I have to disappoint you, Ulrika. My family was not noble, but they were British. So that's true. So take a guess for us. How has COVID-19 rewired our brains when it comes to how we think about finance?
Yeah, I'm incredibly interested in that question. And I am particularly interested in understanding how it has rewired school-aged kids and young adults who were just entering universities. I think for them in particular, it has upended life as they knew it, social interaction, the way school works, the way you approach new interests and try to incorporate them in your lives. And so in terms of their perception of what society is, what friendship is, how learning is done, I think we will see a long impact for years and decades to come. So when we're asking who will be the COVID generation, my guess is that we want to study the kids who experience it at school or beginning of university. And I do predict that the social realm, so again, very far from what I tend to do, how you form connections, how you form family units or friendship units, etc., will be a very interesting part to study. Also, I have started looking a little bit into how it affects your mental health, having just stared at the computer for 2 years and having missed out on these social interactions. So I think those are the areas I'm most interested in. And I am dabbling a little bit in that. I am dabbling what other crises, including the 1918 so-called Spanish flu, did for school-aged kids in the US. I've been looking at the Ebola crisis, where you see long-lasting effects of the schools being closed in Sierra Leone. But I hope a lot of researchers will focus on these younger ages after the COVID-19 crisis.
It's fascinating stuff. It's very challenging, but if my brain is a use-dependent organ, I'm very pleased that we could use it today with this conversation. Thank you very much, Ulrike.
Thank you so much, Tim. This was a great conversation.
If you want to read the discussion paper, I imagine you will after that conversation. It is DP16373@CEPR. It is Experience Effects in Finance, Foundations, Applications and Future Directions. And the author, of course, Ulrike Malmondier. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. Every week we bring you the most important latest research. So if you want to know what you're going to be reading in journals 18 months from now, listen to Vox Talks Economics today. And there are 12 years of Vox Talks Economics at voxeu.org/vox-talks. Or if you subscribed, they're on your phone now.